Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, and Jonathan Hasid, assistant professor of political science at ISU. Jim and Jonathan, welcome to you.
Hi, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
Big news day, of course. We'll devote a lot of the hour to the testimony still ongoing of Donald Trump's former personal lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen. I've been glued to it this morning as I've been preparing for this show as well. Later in the hour, we want to talk also a little bit about how Chuck Grassley, who is now the Senate Finance Committee chairman, invited seven drug makers to testify about drug prices. You know, we here in the U.S. have the highest prescription drug prices of any country. We'll talk a little bit about the Democrats 2020. Of course, we will be talking about those probably every week. Right up to, what is it, February 3rd? Is that our date of our caucuses?
That's right.
Okay. All right. So we've got a long time to go before next February 3rd.
And better weather.
And, well, if that's your promise, I hope it comes true, Jim McCormick. Let's go to the testimony this morning. And I don't know, Jonathan and Jim, did you get it? I know you have teaching duties and so forth, of course, at the university there. Did you both get a chance to at least take in some of it?
Yeah, I watched some of it.
Yeah, yep. I did. Yep.
Okay, very good. We'll hear a few clips of it. These are some a little bit longer than we usually have here. Just to give some context here, testimony this morning of Donald Trump's former personal lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen. Many words used now in the reports to describe it, blistering, searing, this public testimony before Congress. Many things that he says that President Trump knew an advisor was communicating with WikiLeaks, that Trump implicitly instructed Cohen to lie about a Trump Tower project in Moscow during the 2016 campaign. Of course, that Trump, he says, he calls him a con man, a cheat, a racist. Let's listen to a cut in this opening statement. Michael Cohen calling the president an enigma. He said he's become the worst version of himself as he's become president.
Mr. Trump is an enigma. He is complicated, as am I. He is both good and bad, as do we all. But the bad far outweighs the good. And since taking office, he has become the worst version of himself. He is capable of behaving kindly, but he is not kind. He is capable of committing acts of generosity, but he is not generous. He is capable of being loyal, but he is fundamentally disloyal. Donald Trump is a man who ran for office to make his brand great, not to make our country great. He had no desire or intention to lead this nation, only to market himself and to build his wealth and power. Mr. Trump would often say, this campaign was going to be the greatest infomercial in political history. He never expected to win the primary. He never expected to win the general election. The campaign, for him, was always a marketing opportunity. I knew early on in my work for Mr. Trump that he would direct me to lie to further his business interests. And I am ashamed to say that when it was for a real estate mogul in the private sector, I considered it trivial. As the president, I consider it significant and dangerous. But in the mix, lying for Mr. Trump was normalized, and no one around him questioned it. In fairness, no one around him today questions it either.
Michael Cohen in testimony before Congress earlier today. Let's hear from the Republicans, many Republicans on that committee firing back ranking Republican of the House Oversight Committee, Jim Jordan from Ohio, had a fiery opening statement. And as the hearing went on this morning, he accused Michael Cohen of being bitter he did not get a chance to work at the White House.
The chairman just gave you a 30-minute opening statement, and you have a history of lying over and over and over again. And frankly, don't take my word for it. Take what the court said. Take what the Southern District of New York said. Cohen, did crimes that were marked by a pattern of deception and that permeated his professional life. These crimes were distinct in their harms but bear a common set of circumstances. They each involved deception and were each motivated by personal greed and ambition. A pattern of deception for personal greed and ambition, and you just got 30 minutes of an opening statement where you trash the President of the United States of America. Mr. Cohen, how long did you work for Donald Trump?
Approximately a decade.
10 years?
That's correct.
You said all these bad things about the president there in that last 30 minutes, and yet you worked for him for 10 years? All those bad things, I mean, if it's that bad, I can see you working for him for 10 days, maybe 10 weeks, maybe even 10 months. But you worked for him for 10 years.
Okay, Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, on that committee there. Testimony ongoing still of Michael Cohen, the former personal lawyer and fixer of Donald Trump. There'll be so much to pick apart in the coming days from this testimony. It will be digested. Jim McCormick, let me go to you so far. What are you drawing out of it? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think this is a devastating testimony with regard to presidential behavior. I did read the entire 20-page statement that Mr. Cohen gave, and of course, you only played a snippet of it, but there's really more and more evidence of the kind of deception that has taken place. The other thing, and I haven't seen, although they're indicated in the testimony, the various exhibits that he brought into bear to support some of his testimony. But on the other hand, I think the response of Congressman Jordan is exactly what we're seeing in terms of this country, a very divided country here, with some really going to come to the defense of the president, and others, saying, embracing fully what Mr. Cohen has to say. I mean, but just reading the testimony, it is really quite, I guess, shocking. Shocking is too polite a word at this juncture, because we've heard all of these kind of statements in other forums.
Right. Jonathan Haseeb, your initial reaction here.
I mean, I think obviously this is the former personal attorney of the President of the United States, who is now a convicted felon and is facing prison time. I mean, that in and of itself is a big deal. I think Jim is right about partisanship, right? This is probably not going to change too many minds out in the country, but it is, I thought the Republicans' attacks on Cohen, though strident, are rather weak. I mean, I can understand why they're doing it, but to go after Cohen as a liar begs the question as to why Trump employed the liar for 10 years as his personal attorney.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, but don't they have a point here? This is a man who is not only a liar, but someone who is going to serve prison time for lying to Congress, and yet he is before Congress to deliver testimony. Do they not have a point there?
They absolutely do have a point, of course. Cohen is an unreliable witness, an unreliable narrator, and certainly his motives and his testimony have to be questioned. But he's bringing some documentation. Mm-hmm. If he is indeed as sleazy as the Republicans are portraying him, I mean, why was he the president's personal attorney for 10 years and personal fixer? It strikes me that this is a line of attack that the GOP has to use, but it doesn't seem to me to be enormously strong. Though, of course, as you point out, Ben, this is, in fact, a convicted perjurer, so it's mm-hmm. it's legitimate to attack him on those grounds.
They're not really attacking the evidence that he has brought. They're really doing it only in terms of his persona, if you will, and his reputation there. I mean, he had this kind of evidence that he brought forward. It seems to me that they not only are going to do this kind of questioning of his, being convicted, a convicted felon and so on, but they also, it seems to me, the Republicans really want to go in and see if they can challenge some of this evidence that he has provided.
To Michael Cohen's motives, let's listen to him, Michael Cohen himself, trying to explain his motives for appearing this morning at the hearing, saying that he has lied, but he is not a liar, and that he has done fixing things for the president. Let's listen to that little moment.
For those who question my motives for being here today, I understand. I have lied, but I am not a liar. and I have done bad things, but I am not a bad man. I have fixed things, but I am no longer your fixer, Mr. Trump. And I am going to prison and have shattered the safety and security that I tried so hard to provide for my family. My testimony certainly does not diminish the pain that I have caused my family and my friends. Nothing can do that. And I have never asked for, nor would I accept, a pardon from President Trump. And by coming today, I have caused my family to be the target of personal, scurrilous attacks by the president and his lawyer, trying to intimidate me from appearing before this panel. Mr. Trump called me a rat for choosing to tell the truth, much like a mobster would do when one of his men decides to cooperate with the government.
Michael Cohen just minutes ago in testimony before Congress, so he was referring to Representative Matt Gaetz, a Republican of Florida, threatening to reveal what he said were Mr. Cohen's extramarital affairs, and rejecting assertions that his attack could amount to witness intimidation. So there's been a lot of run-up to this testimony as we've seen it. The comparison, Jonathan, to a mobster is not something that we're hearing for the first time either.
No, indeed. I mean, depending on how you look at it, Trump has, many law professors, I think, would argue that the president has engaged in at least attempted witness tampering in public with these kinds of tweets, threatening witnesses, calling them rats, saying things about Roger Stone that, he's a good man because he's staying strong and not cooperating with federal authorities. This is unsettling, right? Regardless of where you sit on the political spectrum, the president of the United States is calling someone for a rat for cooperating with law enforcement, and we haven't been here before as a country, and it's strange.
Mm-hmm. The Republicans firing back, as I say. Here's another example. This is the Republican Representative Mark Green from Tennessee questioning Cohen's credibility to be a witness.
So we're asking a guy going to jail for lying about his debts to comment about the president's debts. He's the expert. Mr. Chairman, your next couple of topics say that I can ask Mr. Cohen about the president's compliance with financial disclosures and campaign finance laws, but didn't Mr. Cohen on two occasions break campaign finance law with his own donation? So again, the majority party's star witness on the president's compliance is a guy who broke compliance laws himself. Mr. Chairman, you graciously allow us to ask questions of Mr. Cohen on the president's dealings with the IRS and tax law. Your star witness here broke the law with regards to the IRS at least five times. He pled guilty on cheating on his taxes, lying to the IRS. He's the best witness you got.
Okay. Jim McCormick, again, back to this credibility issue. What impression did you get of Michael Cohen and the light that the Republicans tried to paint him in here?
Well, I heard that statement of Cohen being very contrite and saying that, I've lied, but I'm not a liar. It does really ring a little bit hollow because it's been going on for a very, very long time, mm-hmm. And as this last little snippet, also raised a question about on an actual behavior on the part of Cohen outside of his actions with regard to Trump here. So, I can understand why, some would be very, very skeptical of embracing too much of or fully embracing what Cohen has to say.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot to pick apart here.
Yes.
As I mentioned before, it's still ongoing. So that transcript is being written as we talk with the live coverage going on right now. But I wonder in the individual points of these investigations, and there are so many heads of these investigations here, it's hard to keep track of them all. But to the main starting point, the Russia investigation, Jonathan, have you heard anything in today's testimony to add to what we know, reshape this question of any possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia?
Potentially. Cohen said that he doesn't have any direct evidence that Trump or his campaign colluded with Russia. But he did say that he was in the room when Trump got a call from Roger Stone, of course, who's currently on trial in Florida, where Stone said that he had been in contact with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, and they were about to release this trove of Hillary Clinton emails. So this is potentially an indirect tie of Trump and his campaign with Russia via WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and Roger Stone. Now, again, Cohen's testimony here is uncorroborated, and it's just, you know, what he said he heard on a speakerphone while Trump was when he was in Trump's office. So we sort of have to take this with a grain of salt. But nonetheless, this is, you know, some more additional evidence that members of the Trump campaign were at least indirectly in contact with the Russians or a Russian cutout in the form of WikiLeaks.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, you know, just to follow up on what Jonathan said, and I don't know the answer to this, but is getting a phone for Stone to talk to Julian Assange, is that some kind of a violation or not, or for Trump to know about that? I mean, it's sort of one or two steps removed from Russian collusion. I mean, I guess
the WikiLeaks information, the data was WikiLeaks obtained it from Russia, right? A Russian hack going to WikiLeaks.
Yeah.
WikiLeaks in contact with Roger Stone. Roger Stone in contact with the president. That's four dots connected. In my mind, if I'm understanding it correctly, you think so, Jonathan?
I do. You know, it's WikiLeaks. We've now known for a while is apparently just a cutout of the Russian intelligence agencies, right? It is not an independent actor. And of course, you know, the president said during the campaign that he, you know, Russia, if you're listening, I want you to hack Hillary Clinton's emails, right? He said that in public at campaign rallies. And so he certainly was asking, whether he was doing it facetiously or not, he was asking, in a sense, for Russia to do this. And then, of course, Russia did. Mm-hmm. There is now some, as I said, indirect evidence that Trump knew and approved of what was going on, which is, you know, a troubling development.
I wonder, you know, back to the question of will this testimony today, when will we look back on it in half year, a year, whatever happens in the future as a sort of a landmark day, we won't know. until we are in the future. But when we look at the way this is treated by the media, I just pulled off some of the headlines here on the web pages of Fox News, for instance. The headline here, contrast these two headlines. This is the Fox News headline, Republicans trash Cohen as convicted liar dismiss claims about Trump's misdeeds. New York Times testifying to Congress, Cohen calls Trump a racist, a con man, a cheat. Politico, Michael Cohen, I am ashamed because I know what Mr. Trump is. I guess my point here, and maybe not perfectly well demonstrated in those quotes of headlines, what can be the future of getting to the truth, for having Americans understand what really happened, when so many Americans are in these silos, pigeonholes? Jim?
Well, It's really the problem of the sort of the 21st century here, of how you get people out of these silos and to read and to digest what other information sort of is available. And I, you know, sort of the cardinal rule is to look at sort of the statements that you disagree with and try to filter those and try to understand. Mm-hmm. But that has become very problematic for people with cell phones and instant looking at news and their favorite app or what have you, so it's a very difficult challenge, it seems to me. And as you pointed out, those headlines I do think make the case that, you know, there are these kind of silos, and to get people to look beyond those silos is a problem. I mean, maybe it's partly it's an educational issue.
Right, we have to be educated.
We come back to where we stand in terms of making certain that, you know, when we teach any classes on this or have any discussion of this, we make sure, as you actually, if I might pat you on the back here, Ben, you know, you try to, you know, make certain that the sort of the different views are heard. And that, I think that's the beginning point only.
Right, and I think I hope it comes through in all of the programming. Certainly, that's our philosophy: fact-based programming. So, whatever news source you consume, make sure that it is fact-based. Jonathan Hasid, your thoughts on the media's role here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's wonderful that we have media that are fact-based. It's also problematic that many of the media increasingly are not, or at least there are sections that are not. You know, the silo effect is very real, and I don't imagine it's going to go away. I mean, it's sort of, we can sort of think about this as a thought exercise. You know, what would have happened to Richard Nixon if there were a Fox News and a right-wing media ecosystem in the same way that there is today? And it may well be that, you know, Nixon wouldn't have resigned, right? And ultimately, the media, of course, shapes the perceptions of facts on the ground. Right now, it's doing it, you know, there's two different, almost completely disconnected media universes. And so people who are concentrating on the facts essentially get you know, two different sets of facts now almost.
Right. And in some case, as opposed to the early 1970s, we don't have the mainstream media in between a lot of the people digesting the news of the day. We have people... subscribe to Donald Trump's Twitter feed. There is no person in between there. It is Donald Trump reaching his constituents.
Yeah, and, you know, if you just look at the decline in trust, right, in all institutions in American life, but in the media especially, it's really been quite precipitous. And so people just, you know, these gatekeepers, I mean, they still exist, right? We still have the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. They still exist, but increasingly they're just ignored.
Yeah, but the trust of the media, you know, just to amplify Jonathan's point, I mean, really has declined, and that makes it difficult for somebody to suggest to somebody that they should look at alternate media sources rather than just to get the kind of reinforcement source that they probably depend upon.
We have a minute or two here left before we go to break. Let's finish this up by asking the two of you to think about what you will be watching as this testimony ends and gets digested over the next few days. Who knows? Maybe there's a bombshell of news tomorrow that will make this seem like old news already. It can happen in this media environment. What will you be watching as this testimony is poured over, digested, interpreted over the course of the next couple of news cycles? Jonathan?
You know, I'm actually going to be watching something a little bit different. I'm going to be watching what the Senate does with the national emergency legislation that has just passed the House. It seems to me that if the testimony of Cohen is really devastating, right, and if it comes out over the next few days that it actually has swayed lots of people, then I think we would expect to see quite a few Republican defections in the Senate to pass this piece of legislation.
We'll talk about that in the next half hour. Yeah. Good point. Quickly, Jim, before we go away, forward-looking, your thoughts?
Well, what I'm actually going to look for in the news cycle is to what extent the news cycle looks at these exhibits that Cohen produced as part of his testimony and see if they dig into those. There was at least one about these 11 different checks that supposedly that it's got Trump's signature on it that he gave to Cohen. I think the rest of those exhibits might be a fertile ground for further exploration.
Okay, we'll be back with our political scientists, Jim McCormick and Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we'll talk about what's happening in Vietnam right now, in Hanoi. President Trump and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un meeting today. I guess the formal talk scheduled for tomorrow. We'll talk about it when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with the Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Jonathan Hasid and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, our political scientists, joining us today as this testimony on Capitol Hill before Congress continues now into, well, it started at 9 o'clock our time here. So you can do the math. It's just starting into hour four of the testimony. Michael Cohen, former personal lawyer and fixer of the president, public testimony, saying many things, calling Mr. Trump a con man, a cheat, a racist. Republicans calling into question Cohen's credibility, saying this is a man who is convicted of lying to Congress, going to serve time for lying to Congress. Why would we trust this man's word? 1-866-780-9100. We do want to get to North Korea and a number of other items, but let's take this call from Pete in Des Moines. Thanks for waiting, Pete. Please be brief and to the point, but we're sure glad you're on the program.
Thank you. The one thing that I heard in the testimony that Cohen gave was the fact that the president, and at the time he wasn't the president, but that they provided false information to Deutsche Bank to secure a loan. That is a criminal offense that the president, as Donald Trump, could be convicted for.
Okay.
That's the only thing that I heard that he's done that puts him in jeopardy in some way.
Okay. Pete in Des Moines, thank you very much. And we remember here, too, that Cohen is providing financial documents to back his testimony, so he can say what he wants. But really, the question earlier this hour from Jim and Jonathan was, how much will the press pay attention and the American people pay attention to the documentation, the evidence, the fact-based journalism here being put to the test? Let's talk about what's happening with the president. Meanwhile, in the other side of the world, in Vietnam, Hanoi, President Trump and the Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, this morning, their time, of course, providing upbeat optics on the launch of their second summit. There were cameras flashing. They met the International Press Corps. They shook hands, the American and North Korean flags in the backdrop. This is the beginning of their second summit meeting in 8 months. They had a formal dinner with top aides. Now the formal talks between Trump and Kim are to take place tomorrow. The U.S., simply put, wants the North Korea government to dismantle its nuclear weapons program. The North Koreans, well, they're seeking numerous concessions, including get rid of these punishing sanctions. Jonathan Haseeb, let's go to you first on this. What are your thoughts about this second summit?
I suspect it's going to achieve just what the first summit did, which is to say very little. You know, Kim made some noises about denuclearizing, but there's been no follow-through. And Trump's own intelligence directors have said that North Korea has no intention of denuclearizing. 8 months ago, Trump announced on Twitter that, quote, there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea, which, of course, is false, according to his own intelligence estimates. And I don't think that North Korea is going to give up their bomb, right? The intelligence estimates don't think the intelligence analysts don't think that North Korea is going to give up their bomb. And I suspect that this is going to be another sort of PR triumph, perhaps, for Trump and certainly for Kim. But in terms of substantive progress, I would be surprised if anything happened.
So you think both leaders are seeing their, in terms of realistic goals, they're in the PR category.
Exactly. I mean, Kim very much wants to be recognized by the world. He doesn't want to be a pariah anymore. He wants to sort of take his place proudly on the world stage, which is something that the president has at least partly given him now. And, of course, Trump wants to, you know, solve the nuclear problem. So Kim, in a sense, is getting what he likes, or at least part of what he wants. He's not going to have the sanctions removed immediately, but he does get a sort of an international respect and stature. Trump also sort of appears to be a statesman, but in terms of substantive concessions, I would be shocked if anything emerged from this meeting.
Mm-hmm. Jim, are you as pessimistic as your colleague Jonathan here is about what this is likely to yield?
Yes, I am. I think that, you know, President Trump is putting all kinds of weight on the idea of personal diplomacy and, you know, that he can think that he can, over time, persuade Kim to give up these nuclear weapons here. But I'm very, very skeptical. You know, we have seen this with past leaders of North Korea who are patient and wait out any kind of deal that is made. And it really is reflective, if I might add, a little bit about foreign policy making on the part of the U.S. As a society, we are very impatient for solutions. And as you can see with Kim and even with China, if you expand it to China, they're willing to wait and use time in their own for their own capacity here. So I think that at best we're going to see a kind of a reaffirmation that they're working towards denuclearization, but this is going to take time. We've already seen that in terms of some of the messages, even before the meeting, that they've sort of pulled back, that this is going to happen very quickly, and this is kind of a process. I know that Secretary of State Pompeo, in one of the interviews on the Sunday program, was talking about that this is really a process that that will have to occur. So I think that there's really been a pullback of what the expectation should be.
Jim McCormick and Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, our political analysts on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Let's get back to the national emergency. That was the big news a couple weeks ago, with reverberations to yesterday when the U.S. House voted to overturn the president's declaration of a national emergency on the Mexican border. 13 Republicans breaking ranks, joining the Democrats to try to block this effort, the effort here to divert funding to a border wall without congressional approval. Now, this resolution of disapproval passed 245 to 182 in the House. The Democrats, of course, having the majority there by, I think, some 40 seats. Now it has to be taken up by the Senate. In the Senate, we're hearing three Republicans already declaring their support. That's a key number because it's one vote short of the number needed for Congress to ratify this measure. But Jonathan, talk a little bit about that. That would still be far short of a two-thirds vote needed to overturn a presidential veto, which the president has promised.
That's right. So the way the National Emergencies Act was originally designed was that Congress could, by a simple majority, disapprove. It's never been done before, but disapprove a presidential emergency declaration. Since that act was passed, the Supreme Court has struck down the so-called legislative veto. And so what it means is that Trump can veto this legislation, right, that comes through. And there's not going to be the votes to override it. There might not even be the votes in the House, let alone the Senate, to override the presidential veto. And so the national so-called emergency declaration will proceed. Right? This is essentially a piece of political theater that Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrats are doing to sort of get Republicans on the record as to whether or not they support the declaration of an emergency. The practical effect of this is going to be pretty small because of the veto.
Mm-hmm. And Jim, maybe a bit of a civics lesson here, but what is the case that the Democrats in the House are making here that the president does not have the right to this is the position, this is the right of the Congress, this is the power, these are the powers of the Congress, not the president?
Right. I think there's a couple things here. First of all, that in fact the Congress has the right to appropriate funds that should be used for this kind of adventure in terms of this wall. That's sort of kind of a principal reason, and they even some of the senators have sort of embraced. The second part of that, it seems to me, is that there's really not a crisis. So the definition is really not being satisfied. Although, actually, if you go back to the National Emergencies Act, the crisis there is really not very much defined, and it does leave it pretty wide open for the president. But I think those two reasons, that there's an appropriations issue and there's a definitional issue that really motivates the House. And I think that it's really unlikely that they'll probably get the votes in the Senate to send it to the president, and he'll veto it, as Jonathan said. But I think that, in fact, they won't even get an override in the House, because you really need about 291 votes, if my math is correct, in terms of getting two-thirds. And they only got 13 Republicans. And there's going to be I can't imagine there would be any further defections here on the part of Republicans. I was surprised that the Democrats only got 13 Republicans to go along. And I was looking at the sort of the display of where they were from, sort of some of the districts. It's really an odd combination of some from Texas, from Washington. There's a couple from Michigan, a couple from Wisconsin, and then so a couple or three or four northeastern states representatives as well. So I think it'll be stopped even in the House, and the Senate won't have to have a second vote, which will probably save a number of members who now on this first vote will probably back the president.
Mm-hmm. At least four lawsuits, perhaps more, that I wasn't aware of, challenging the president's authority in declaring this emergency for his border wall. I know the ACLU, the collection of states, I think 16 states, another one on behalf of border landowners, an environmental organization. This just gets at the point. Will this, Jonathan, will this money be diverted as the president has directed?
No. I mean, the lawsuits are going to hold things up for a long time. I mean, the question with the lawsuits is who has standing to sue. This is a complicated legal question. Courts won't take a lawsuit from just a random person. You have to be directly affected by an ongoing event, which gives you standing. And the law on standing is very, very complicated. And so to date, because nothing has yet been built, the money hasn't yet been appropriated, right, As far as I can tell, no one yet has standing to sue.
Well, maybe the rancher in southern Arizona or somewhere.
Yeah, maybe, but I don't think
or
any
Texas
land has
maybe.
Been seized yet, right?
Yeah,
so that's
right. Uh-huh.
So you can't, it's, you know, you can't sue about a prospective harm. You can only sue about a harm that's actually happened. And so there will be ranchers suing when their land is seized, but until then, yeah. It seems to me that the courts are going to throw this out. That said, this is going to delay the process for a very, very long time. Trump certainly won't get any or very little of the wall built during this term. And so this is clearly something he's sort of queuing up to run on in 2020, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even because he's going to say, you know, we didn't complete the wall. You have to send me back to complete it. So this is a political journey more than a perhaps a legal one.
Mm. Let's talk about this closing minutes of our program today. Yesterday, members of the Senate Finance Committee, now chaired by our U.S. Senator Grassley, this committee grilling pharmaceutical executives. There's really quite a display if you saw some of the video during a public hearing about their role in rising drug costs. Yes, we Americans pay the highest prescription drug prices in the world. Now, the leaders of these seven drug companies told members of the Senate they want to do something about these high prescription drug costs, but they wouldn't commit to dropping the listed prices. These drug makers blamed a convoluted supply chain involving insurance companies, middlemen, whom they argue do not pass on savings to patients. Well, yesterday, the Iowa Senator Republican Chuck Grassley held this was the second in a series of hearings examining why these prescription drugs are so high in price. Here's what he had to say in a call with reporters.
Prices for some medications like insulin have skyrocketed, even though nothing about them has changed in many, many decades.
Okay. He also questioned rebates and other methods companies use to bring prices down.
Why is it that the price is so high, but then you come along and you have a whole bunch of rebates and the price is lower? So shouldn't the consumer be paying the lower price, and why don't we start out with that lower price?
Senator Grassley echoing the outrage from the American public. Jim, let me go to you on this. We have these very high drug prices. Will this do anything about it, this sort of testimony? Can Congress do anything about it?
Well, I think mainly what it does is get the issue on the agenda, and it's already been seized by some of the Democratic candidates here. And so I think that is a kind of the merit that Senator Grassley's action and the other members of the Finance Committee have. It can actually shame some of these companies, perhaps. I noted, and you know, the senator talked about you know, these kind of middle persons that really can have an impact in terms of turning some of those rebates that they receive back to the public, and maybe something could be done legislatively, you know, in sort of that interim amount that can be rebated and how much it should be rebated. I don't know if that could be legislation that could actually get through the legislative mill or not.
Mm-hmm. A quick few minutes on our Democratic 2020 candidates. Former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro has been meeting with voters around our state this week. IPR's Western Iowa reporter Katie Pikus went to a meeting with him in Denison, out in the western part of the state, talking about, he was talking there about the what he called the false choice between having secure borders and being humane. Let's hear a few seconds of that.
We're always going to need a secure border, and we can make investments to ensure that our border is always secure. But we can also be humane and not take children away from their mothers or their fathers.
Okay, Julian Castro, a declared candidate here. We've been trying to get the voices of the candidates, and there are many of them as they declare. Well, last week we had Senator Warren, Senator Klobuchar, Sanders there as well. Let's get some quick comments before we head out of this show on our field there. Jonathan, tell us what your thoughts are at this point as we have, what, more than a dozen or so?
I mean, there's certainly a lot of them, a lot to keep track of. Castro maybe is sort of moderately competitive. He has a name inside the party. He gave a well-received speech at the DNC, I forget when, a few cycles ago. And of course, he has some, you know, experience as Obama's Secretary of Health and Human Services. And he, of course, coming from Texas probably helps him too. I mean, there's always a push in the Democratic Party to turn Texas blue. It seems perhaps to be inching closer and closer. Senator Cruz in his last reelection cycle only won by about 3 points or 4 points. So, you know, if Texas is in play, that's obviously a very big get for the Democrats. I mean, that said, there's so many candidates, it's, you know, hard to know who's going to rise to the top. Mm-hmm. I do think that Klobuchar was likely hurt a lot by these stories coming out of the New York Times and other places about her treatment of staff, and in particular this sort of comb incident that she had supposedly involving a salad. Eating a salad with a comb. You know, this is the kind of story that people remember, right? This is the kind of thing that sticks in people's heads. And although it's a totally trivial thing,
right,
it is, I think, likely to now be indelibly associated with her.
Well, and also gender politics being brought up in this context, right, Jonathan? Because we're saying, you know, a leader being hard driving with staff is something that's if it's a man, it may be looked at one way. If it's a woman leader, it may be looked at in a different way.
That's absolutely true, of course. I mean, if you look at, you know, a lot of male politicians have famously mistreated their staff, but they're not really, you know, victimized or venomized for it. So if we think about LBJ is perhaps the most prominent example that comes to mind. He was apparently quite malicious and horrible to his staff, but it was seen as part of being a strong leader. But you're right that, you know, when a woman does it, the gender dynamics definitely shape perception here.
Jim, jump in here.
I think Joe Biden is the issue that's going to come up here in the next several days. He's already given very, very loud hints that he's going to get back into the race, and I think that is going to begin to shake up this field of 11 or 12 candidates already. You know, he has great name recognition, obviously. He's a great campaigner, and I think we'll start to get some shape of this set of candidates once he gets into the race.
Mm-hmm. Let me read a couple sentences from a Politico article having to do with this before we say goodbye today. This is from Politico. Democratic Party chairs in the four early presidential states are working to convince the 2020 presidential candidates to avoid waging social media disinformation warfare against each other. The effort began this week with a letter to state party chairs across the country, broadly laying out the issue with an ultimate goal of establishing what amounts to a non-aggression pact, according to a copy of the letter obtained by Politico. This involves Iowa's Troy Price when they're naming the heads of the parties in the various states. Disinformation is here. Boy, did it ever make its presence felt in the 2016 campaign. So what do you see the Democrats doing here, Jonathan?
I mean, I imagine that lots of people will sign it. Now, whether or not they'll obey it is another matter. I mean, it's easy to do this kind of thing at arm's length. You hire a campaign firm, right, and they hire somebody else. You hire somebody else, and you do online disinformation that way. I think the genie is out of the bottle on this one. You know, it was apparently tried and perhaps effectively in the Alabama Senate race the last election cycle against Roy Moore by the Democrats with perhaps some effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so I imagine everyone's going to publicly say that we support this, but privately it's impossible to control.
When it comes down to it, it'll be sort of like, I will not have any negative campaign ads.
Right, exactly.
And then when it's a close race, well, let's haul out the big guns, right? The ones that are proven effective, right, Jim?
Right. I say good luck.
Good luck with what?
To put this in play here, because I think, as Jonathan is right, that they may say sign on, but they will not adhere to it. I mean, what I thought of when I heard about this was, is this equivalent to Ronald Reagan's view about not criticizing other Republicans going back to his campaign?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the rule that he supposedly put into effect.
Thou shalt not criticize a fellow Republican.
That's right. And this sounds similar to that rule, and those rules apparently were broken.
Right.
Or are broken.
But undeniably, we are a different populace than we were in 2016. Wiser to false information, to these sort of disinformation campaigns, Jonathan, you think, with a closing word on that? Please say yes.
No. Definitely not. I mean, if anything, things are likely worse now because there are all these experiments that people can do, and so you know what works and what doesn't.
Okay. I'm going to slink away from the microphone and cry in a corner somewhere. No. All right. Thank you very much. Jonathan Haseed, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at ISU. Thanks for coming into our AIM studio, guys. We appreciate it, and we look forward to having you on next time.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River, produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. Also helped today from Stephanie Nobrega. Sean McClain helped us out in Ames. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.